Black Americans have been stolen from. A dollar stolen compounds over time. And we're looking at the effects of 400 years of theft, first explicitly in terms of labor during slavery, but then afterward with Jim Crow, and then afterward with the new Jim Crow. We're looking at centuries of systemic theft from Black Americans, and we need to not only put that money back and invest in our communities, we need to invest with interest.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Stephen Smith was online engagement director at Buttigieg for President. He has a great story about how he ended up in that role and what he did to help Buttigieg supporters fight back online. Stephen is a thoughtful person with an intersection of interests, training, and experience that are highly relevant to this time in our nation's history, including race, gender, and digital politics. I really liked him, and he's well worth your listen. So with that as background, my interview with Stephen Smith.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
How's your day so far?
I'm very fortunate that I sit at the intersection, and I'm thankful to sit at the intersection of so many of the current conversation topics. So much of this is about race. And so I got my master's in race and gender in American history in 2012 from USC. So like, I feel very briefed on that conversation.
Yeah.
I've done the reading.
Yeah.
And I've also taught it. And I think that's the thing that gives me a little bit of hope about the spot where we're in. I spent 3 semesters teaching the race and gender survey class at USC. And so it's a mandatory class. And so you've got kids in there who really want the race and gender stuff. And then you've got, you know, athletes who are in the class because they have to, and it's a requirement. You have people who are just there because it fit their schedule. And so how do you explain race and gender who are there in a classroom for people who really maybe don't care and get them to care? How do you convince people, how do you convince white people, especially who are maybe a little bit on the fence about how things are playing out at the moment? How do you convince them that Black lives actually do matter? How do you historicize this moment? So it's like, actually, this is not the sort of, what is it, the property destruction and the looting, whatever. In the grand scheme of things, like, that's nothing.
There's been worse violence.
The violence perpetrated against Black Americans in our communities every single day is the sort of banal evil that we've all come to expect. And so you look at a burning Target or you look at a burning CVS, and that seems sort of unusual and extraordinary and against, you know, oh my God, it's property damage. But what you don't see is the violence and communities of, all right, let's cut this neighborhood in half with a highway. That is violence. Let's you know, get rid of mom and pop businesses. Let's bring in, you know, large chains. Let's not invest in grocery stores so that people don't have access to
food. Or let's stop and frisk everybody who looks a certain way.
It's the violence in Black communities is everyday and persistent, and it seems to only get attention when it spills over in and sort of overflows. And so the question becomes in this moment is, we seem to have passed the point of overt violence that got the news cameras, right? And that violence ended, I think the violent phase of things ended with Trump's political stunt in front of the church and the tear gas and, you know, clearing the protesters. That was the sort of visual of state violence. We seem to have moved past the violence part of things, which means we're on to the solutions part. And that's where we keep dropping the ball.
That's where the rubber hits the road.
It's where the rubber hits the road, and it's where decisions have to be made and priorities have to be set, and real organizing has to happen. And so we're still in this corona phase. So how do we organize for our lives in a moment where it's really not safe to be in public and traditional campaign or organizing techniques aren't on the table and aren't sitting there for everybody to grab? So how can this moment sort of catalyze and crystallize the sort of progress we need to make? And how do we turn this momentum into something sustainable?
All very good questions. Stefan, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. I'm Stefan Smith. I'm the former online engagement director for Pete Buttigieg's presidential campaign. Before that, I was doing digital for Democrats and progressive causes for the last 5 years, working in rural New Mexico as digital director for the Democratic Party of New Mexico, digital director for Mayor Marty Walsh's reelection in Boston, senior digital strategist for Senator Martin Heinrich, and deputy digital director in Michigan for Hillary Clinton's presidential run. I spent the last 5 years really trying to figure out, how do you tell interesting stories online? How do you build more inclusive spaces online? And how do you elect change makers? How do you bring people into office that can speak to and for the people?
Stefan, where did you grow up?
I grew up in what was then a very small town, Greenville, South Carolina, which, if you know South Carolina, you know it is no longer a small town. I grew up in public housing. I grew up with a single parent, white mother, who was disabled in a car accident and sort of could no longer walk when I was 13. And so I sort of had to step up and run the household. I like to tell people I grew up in one of those white savior movies where it's just sort of like black boy, bad neighborhood, single parent, public housing, education was the way out. And it seems sort of stereotypical, but it's very much my story. I was very, very lucky that my mother worked for the government growing up. And so she got a computer for our household in 1997, 1998. And we were the only people I knew up until high school who had a computer at home. And so you couldn't go outside. It was too dangerous. And so I got to essentially spend my adolescence and teenagers growing up online in a way that Gen Zers see as normal, but wasn't exactly normal for older millennials at the time. And was able to sort of figure out, how does the internet work and what does it look like, and use it sort of almost as an escape from sort of the bad neighborhood and the bad nest that was happening around in the community. After that, I went to Brown University, graduated with a degree in history, and then moved to Southern California to start my PhD, where I was focusing on race, gender, and material culture in America. What does it mean to be American? And how do race, gender, and the things we buy influence that? And so that's what I was working on, writing my dissertation. And I just got bored. it sounds awesome. I mean, it sounds horrible to say this, but you write, you know, I passed my quals, I'm ABD, I had 1 year left on fellowship. Everyone was telling me, just shut up and finish, right? Just, it doesn't matter. The best dissertation is a done dissertation. But I just couldn't get out of my head that, you know, there are going to be 5 people who read this thing. And I'm interested in systemic change. I'm interested in telling different stories. I'm entering in, you know, what Toni Morrison called, I'm interested in what moves at the margins. And so I left the PhD program and worked, you know, as a Postmates driver and delivery guy until I got a job working for Drunk History, where I spent season 4 of Drunk History as their principal researcher, helping pitch stories, and then became their first on-set social media person. And that really sort of kickstarted me realizing that there's other places to tell stories, and you can reach a bigger audience, and you can shape more people's opinions of the world by grabbing digital and combining it with pop culture and also eventually doing the political work. So I did Drunk History for a season and then wound up getting hired for Hillary Clinton's campaign in Michigan. And sort of that started the political journey.
I have a few questions about that completely interesting and non-standard route to kind of the digital political world. So what I wasn't clear about, was your father African-American? Were you adopted? What was the white mother?
I tell people I'm like, you know, the old school mix, black dad, white mom. Me and my brother and sister were the only mixed people we knew growing up. South Carolina in the 90s was not exactly a hotbed of racial progressivism.
No, and Greenville was a pretty conservative town.
Greenville's still a very conservative town. Lindsey Graham's going to have a hard time getting support here this cycle, not because he's too far to the right, but because people still think he's not far enough. Greenville's a very, very conservative place. And so, no, grew up here with a white mom and a black dad in a predominantly black neighborhood in a town where sort of everyone was very Confederate and Confederate flags on your trucks and Confederate flags on your belt. Yeah. It was a very strange and unique upbringing.
I kind of related to your only computer in the neighborhood thing. For me, that was 1981. We were just early adopters. My parents got an Apple II Plus, and I learned to program on that. But what was it about the computer that captured you, and what kind of things were you doing on the internet? Did you build things, or did you just explore information? What were you doing?
When you grow up poor, and you grow up black, and you grow up different, you're constantly looking for worlds outside of yourself. You're looking for things you read about or things you can't imagine. And so for me, it started with, you know, Encarta encyclopedia CDs. And then we got AOL. And so I spent a lot of time, entirely too much time as a child, hanging out in AOL chat rooms. So, you know, the Spice Girls chat room or Pool Party 23 or very much rooms that nowadays I should not have been allowed and you wouldn't let a 10 or 12 year old child into. But at the time, there were no real parental controls. And so for me, what the internet was a place and a way to see a world that to me didn't exist in my everyday. It didn't exist for me, the idea of, you know, I just think about all the books I learned about because of the internet and this feeling of like, oh my God, there's so much out there that I've never seen because the bookstore in my community was very small and was independent and didn't have a lot of material. What it did and what I was doing online really was trying to see a world that I couldn't see out my door. This was a time when crack was still very, very big. The sort of drug epidemic that ravaged my community was huge. So it's, you know, I'm sitting on a computer learning about, you know, I don't know, pyroclastic volcanic eruptions and, you know, Iceland's shifting tectonic plate and hanging out, you know, talking about, you know, British pop music while outside someone's banging on the door to be let in. And, you know, we're having to decide, are we calling the police or are we not calling the police? For me, what the internet was a chance to see a world and experience a world and to meet people that otherwise I would never have encountered. And I very much count myself as someone who was saved by digital. There's a completely different sliding doors version of reality where I didn't get that computer. My mother didn't have that job. And that universe, I'm in jail or I'm working, you know, minimum wage somewhere. Because I couldn't and didn't see a place for myself. That's what the internet does, and it does it in so many different communities, and that's what we should be thinking about when we think about what digital can do, is that it can create new ways of thinking, new ways of encountering the world. When I say it saved my life, I'm not being hyperbolic. I'm pretty certain it saved my life.
Did you happen to read The Other Wes Moore?
I did not. Do I need to add that to a list?
Yeah. It's about Wes Moore, who's now runs the Robin Hood Foundation in New York, who grew up in Baltimore, and his path was a very achieving path. But there was another Wes Moore who ends up in jail. His life could have been this other Wes Moore's life very easily, but for a few breaks. And it's a pretty meaningful book. It sounds like you had a curiosity, a kind of innate curiosity, and that served you in good stead. How did you end up at Brown? You must have been an awfully good student.
I was a great student. I was a great student. I was the kid who was smart and finished things early, and so bothered with the other kids. I ended up at Brown. I applied to 19 colleges, and so
wow,
yeah, you know, I mailed all 19 of my applications. How did I end up at Brown? It was the last school I applied to. I started out very small. Nobody in my family had gone to college. Nobody in my family had even thought about four-year college, let alone an Ivy League institution. And I certainly had no clue about how to pay for college. And so I started out very small, applying to very small liberal arts schools in South Carolina. That process gave me confidence. All right, I've done that. Let's go a little bit bigger. You know, Duke, Emory, Vanderbilt. All right. Once those were done, it was, all right, let's expand it a little bit. And so eventually it got to the point where I felt confident enough applying to them. They loved me. They loved my application. The admissions officer, who I will always remember, his name is Elisha Anderson at Brown. He told me I had one of the top 25 applications they received that year. Because what the application was for me is I just wrote about my life. This is what this is. This is what this looks like. This is where I want to go. And this is why this matters. And so Brown flew me to campus for free and showed me, and that was my first time on an airplane, to show me their campus and convince me to come. And I met with their financial aid people and they explained to me that this was possible for me. And so I said, yes. Brown is one of those places that I will forever be grateful to, because it taught me, I think, one of the biggest life lessons I needed to learn, which was you're not running the race against other people. Brown doesn't have class rank. Brown does not have pluses or minuses for grading. They don't have GPAs. You can make your own major if one of the 100 plus they have doesn't fit you. And so what Brown's whole thing is about is you're not running a race against other people. You're running the race against yourself. And once you take other people out of it and you focus on yourself and your own journey and making sure that you're the best, then you get where you're going. And that mentality was not something I had ever encountered before. Everything I knew about education, everything I knew about learning was like, all right, get this grade, right? Get this 5 on this AP test. Brown taught me a new way of thinking about the world, which is not one of adversarial competition, and instead one about personal development and growth.
That sounds like an immensely important lesson, one that a lot of people never pick up and other people kind of struggle for in their 50s or something. So
it really sped up the process of growth. One of the best things I did at Brown, Brown's very big on community service, is me and two friends of mine founded a tutoring program that went into a juvenile correctional facility and taught them GED prep so that when they were ready, they could take the test and graduate with their degree or something, a degree equivalent, so they can get jobs. Brown was 100% supportive of going off campus, getting involved in the community. Before I joined Brown, I was a crisis line operator and continued that. Like, their commitment and like sort of pushing us to be more service oriented helped me, especially now that I work in politics, it helped me really focus on what's important. And what's important is not like my own personal glorification. What's important is am I making a difference? Am I helping? And I think not a lot of colleges impart that in their students.
Well, what was it that you were learning there that put you on a path of thinking, what I want is a PhD in race and gender and things like that?
That's a great question. I accidentally triple majored in history. So because there are no required classes at Brown, you take whatever you want. So I wound up taking something like 20 history courses. And for me, I find that I just found history fascinating. History, I think, to sort of paraphrase Joan Didion, it's like history is the stories we tell ourselves so that we can live, right? How do we order the world? How do we narrativize what's happened to us and what we've experienced and who gets emphasized and who doesn't? And so in the process of learning, it became very clear to me that like people were being excluded from this narrative, partly because of systemic issues like racism and misogyny, partly because, you know, nobody's really thought about certain sources in a way that would prioritize people of color. And partly because history is, especially history of America, non-slavery focused, is very, very white. Academia is probably one of the whitest places I've ever encountered, not just in terms of the people there, but in terms of the sort of point of view that is put forward. And so I saw that and I thought, that's not the way this is supposed to be. It's very naive. It was a very, 21-year-old looking at the world like, oh, I can fix this. I'm like, this is, yeah, they need more Black people to come in and help them tell this story. And I want to tell these stories. That helped. And then I got a fellowship with the Center for the Study of the American Presidency, and then got his fellowship with the Mellon Mays Foundation, which helps people of color go and do their PhD and provides training and helps with research project. And that sort of accelerated me. And so I thought, okay, I love this life of the mind. I love teaching. I love narrative. It seemed like the perfect fit. So we ended up applying and then wound up in Southern California, which is about as different from Providence, Rhode Island as you can get.
Well, I kind of relate to your PhD path because I, after an undergrad degree, took a few years working, and then I went to get a PhD in political science, and I was ABD, finished my exams, and then left. I kind of realized that I was not going to be a professor, that I would be fairly miserable, probably. And so I started a company. I relate to that, but you do pick up quite a bit in a PhD program. It's a different way of thinking. What did you pick up?
I would not be successful in politics without my PhD education at all. A history PhD, the average in the United States is something like 7 years. And so what a PhD in history or what a graduate program in history really does is it teaches you how to consume large amounts of information, synthesize it down to its essentialness, and then regurgitate that information to others.
I find that very hard.
I found it very easy because I'm, for me, sorry, that sounded super cocky. I apologize.
It's all right. It's the way your brain works and the way you train your brain.
Exactly. I have a near photographic memory, so I didn't have a problem, you know, and I'm a quick reader. So for me, it's like, okay, great. 350 page book on the rise of capitalism and the Dutch East India Company. And sure, I'll read that and be able to participate. When I think of something that seems commonplace in my digital life, it's things like, all right, let me look and see what Twitter's doing and then figure out what the conversation is. And then figuring out how my clients or political candidates or whomever can hold on to or harness that moment, right? That's the same skill set. It's a ridiculous amount of information that you have to consume fairly quickly, figure out what is the sort of mood or tenor or movement or moment happening on that platform, and then figuring out, okay, great, what's the intervention that I can make in this space? And that's very much how historians work. So things like that helped me out a lot. And it also, there's nobody on the digital side of politics really with an academic background. Nobody really approaches digital from a space of, you know, what does the literature say about this? And I think that gives me a little bit of a leg up, because the first thing I do when I have a new project is I immediately try and jump to JSTOR or I go to Google Scholar. When I was building out Pete Buttigieg's online engagement program, I read something like 30 or 40 articles on online engagement, platform management, sociology on, or social science research on, how do you talk online to create community? And so I like did the homework and was able to build a program for Pete that was not just sort of grounded in the needs of the campaign or sort of built on what I'd seen other people necessarily do, and was instead built on like, okay, there's a really great article that, you know, looks at the Bernie Sanders digital campaign in 2016 and breaks down how their digital organizing model worked and the places it succeeded and the places it failed. Like, I doubt very sincerely that, like, you know, huge numbers of digital professionals have read this article. I read it backwards and forwards. It's one of those things where it's like, okay, great. I trust the research here. They've done the lit review and paired it with best practices according to sort of theoretically what we should be doing. And I have a test case from a candidate who's organizing online I really respect. And so I was able to build Pete something that was sort of grounded in both of those. And so for me, what the PhD really, really did is it gave me the tools to formulate different questions and then the skills to be able to go and find the answers.
That seems like a pretty good fit for Pete's campaign, because he because he himself is such a, you know, an intelligent fellow.
He is such a nerd. I love Pete. I love Pete so much. That is a nerd all the way through.
I mean, I really admire people who are interested in learning and combine what they learn from scholars and other practitioners that study these things with the real world, you know, to make things happen. But let's just jump ahead since we're talking about it. How did you get the job and how did you kind of build your place within the campaign?
I was hired by Tom Steyer, or almost about to be hired by Tom Steyer. this is the first I've ever told the story publicly. So in January of 2019, Tom Steyer flew me and his team flew me to San Francisco to interview. And so they were going to hire me as their creative director. I left. We were going to do the offer. I was super pumped. And then 2 days after that, he decided he wasn't going to run. And so I was back in New Mexico. I started interviewing with other candidates. And it was very much a feeling of like, nothing feels quite right. And so there were some candidates, I'm like, this just wouldn't work. And so I kept hearing in the back of my head about Pete. I know people who went to Brown who know Pete. And so they're whispering in my ear. I had professional friends who, you know, one of my friends named Eric is friends with Liz Smith. They're both New York comms people. And he's saying, you've got to look into this mayor. You've got, and they just sort of were very much pushing. And so in about beginning of March 2019, I put in an application, said yes. All right, great. Yes. Flag if it's helpful. Not thinking anything would come of it. Not thinking, one, that he was really hiring or pay. I didn't know if he was taking this super seriously. I liked his positions, what I could tell. I watched a bunch of his interviews. I, you know, bought his book and started reading it. Don't tell anybody, I have not finished that book.
I started it also.
I have the shortest way home. What's the shortest way to the end of this book? I'm trying.
Come on, you're used to reading 350-page history tomes.
I started reading it, and then I got the call to be interviewed. And so I did the round of interviews and then got the job and then moved to South Bend. I was something like the 17th person hired on the campaign. I was the third Black person hired on the campaign, third or fourth, Black person hired on the campaign. And so I just sort of uprooted my life and moved to South Bend. That started, I got hired originally as the creative content manager. And that was really at that time, whatever needed to be done. This was the sort of the persistent thing throughout the entire campaign is we just never had as much staff as anybody else. When the campaign ended, I think Bernie Sanders had more than double the number of paid staffers than Pete had. Elizabeth Warren had more staffers than everyone had more staff than Pete. And so those first few months were really triage. It was, you need someone to send SMS messages? That's me. You need somebody to write website copy? Sure, I'll help. You need somebody to run the platforms? Great. You need someone to strategize. So it became the sort of catch-all of whatever online needed to be done, which was fantastic and sort of super exciting. The Wild West days of the campaign, if you talk to Pete Buttigieg staffers who were there in those first 3 or 4 months, it was great. And then we started to win and go up in the polls and raise money. And so it became really about, all right, now's the time to specialize. So then I got a promotion and became deputy platforms director, primarily in charge of the video platforms. How do we tell stories in video? So that's Snapchat, that's Instagram Story. How do we use these very, very different platforms? And there's different expectations that come with video on, say, an Instagram Story versus a Snapchat that seem super superficial, but if you do them wrong, nobody's going to see your content. And so really, really drilled down into that. One of the things I'm super proud of being on that campaign is we were one of the first campaigns to do simultaneous debate coverage on all platforms. So literally by the time the debate ended, you could pretty much see all of Pete's answers up on all of our platforms, vertical and horizontal, that like literally when by the time the debate was over with. So it was really about streamlining, figuring out how to tell really interesting, inclusive stories, really trying to push forward on the idea that we should meet people everywhere. There's a tendency in campaigns, and I'm sure you can understand why, there's a tendency in campaigns to focus primarily on Twitter. There's too much focus on Twitter because Twitter moves quickly. Twitter is where the blue check marks are. Twitter is where the people in politics you respect are. It's super easy to see what people are doing on that platform. But Twitter doesn't necessarily move a lot of votes. Twitter doesn't necessarily change minds. It's a good mobilizing platform. It's not necessarily a great persuasive platform. And when you're trying to turn the mayor of the fourth largest city in Indiana into president of the United States, you're going to need to do a little bit of persuading. As deputy platforms director, I really, really focused on making sure we were everywhere. And we were telling really interesting stories and telling Pete's story and really lifting up policies. And I'm trying to decide how deep to bring you into this. I think I'm just going to tell you something that nobody outside the campaign knows. So in December, something happened online And Pete started losing followers on certain platforms. It's very, very rare for a candidate to go negative online. And so I'm tracking everybody else. I'm tracking the other primary candidates. Joe Biden went negative a couple of times in December that same month. But we're looking and we're like, what's happening? And so I spent maybe 10 days doing a deep dive on all the data, reading up on everything. And what I found was that our engagements amongst our actual hardcore supporters across platforms were going down. They weren't sharing our content as much. They weren't liking it as much. The comments were primarily becoming negative underneath our content. So I tracked that back, and it was the last week of November. The first poll came out showing Pete ahead in Iowa, and then showed us neck and neck or slightly ahead in New Hampshire that same week. And then we had the contrast debate with Warren at the end of November. And so what had happened was the number of trolls had increased. The number of anti-Pete posting across all of our platforms had increased. The knives were out for Pete. This is around the time of the Michael Harriet piece, you know, Pete Buttigieg is a lying motherfucker. So I'm looking at these numbers and everything is sort of flashing, you know, danger Will Robinson. So I sat down and wrote out what we can do. I wrote two memos. The first memo was three pages and it was a, let's just protect what we can and make it to Iowa. And it was, here's how we would do that. Let's build up a walled garden around our Facebook. Let's shift our video content to YouTube and make sure the comments are turned off. It was a very protectionist stance. And then I wrote another memo that was, if we really want to fight back, everything I'm hearing is that our supporters have gone quiet because they're afraid. The Bernie Sanders people online were very aggressive, as were the supporters of a couple of other candidates. And so our supporters, a lot of whom had, you know, signed up for Twitter because of Pete, or who weren't digitally native. We had a huge number of people who liked Pete who were older women, women over the age of 50, who are not digitally savvy and aren't used to people jumping on their comments being mean to them. They just aren't used to it. They're not as inured to it as you or me or someone else would be. And so what had happened was they had just stopped. They still supported Pete. They still loved us, but they had just stopped sharing. They'd stopped engaging because they were afraid of being attacked. And so I wrote sort of break the glass number two, which was what would we do and what would we build if we wanted to build an online army? If we wanted to give these people who love Pete the training and support they needed to like proselytize for this candidate and feel good about it. How do we make sure that they're not being discouraged by the negativity online, of which there is a lot and there was a lot? So I took both plans to leadership. Spoiler alert, we ended up choosing door number two. And so I became online engagement director in January of 2020 and really spent 2 days reading every single article I humanly possibly could on online engagement and online community building and networks and how do you secure networks and going platform by platform. There's amazing work being done in the Netherlands on Twitter, for instance, and Twitter building communities. There's really amazing work being done in Eastern Europe on Instagram and affect and sort of behavioral science, looking at what do people respond to on that platform. So I just dived into the research. This goes back to the academic thing. I've got a new job. I've got a new problem. How do we fix it? And so what I built was the Digital Captains Program that started out very small and ended up with over 1,000 volunteers, primarily in Super Tuesday states, who were trained on creating their own content. Who we had an entirely volunteer-run data team. We had a hype team that was essentially rapid response, but we didn't want to call it rapid response because the literature is very clear that rapid response or things like that, that may turn it negative. You're going to feel like your actions are about responding to the negative. We wanted to focus on the positive. So by just changing the name, we'll call it hype. That puts users in the right mindset for what they should be doing, what the task ahead is, which is hyping up Pete Buttigieg. So we built out this volunteer army of over 1,000 people and really got to work online. And so it took 8 days after the launch of the program for our numbers to completely reverse from December. And so we solved that problem and got stronger online and raised thousands and thousands of dollars just by really listening and building a program that was based not only in sort of the academic research, but was tailored towards fixing a very real problem on the campaign, which was our supporters loved Pete. They just didn't know how to fight for him online. And so they needed some help to do that. And so that was really what I did for the last 3 months of the campaign, was helping our supporters fight for Pete online.
That's very fascinating. What is your attitude towards the advocates of other candidates who went after Pete in that way? Do you think it's like all fair in politics? Do you think things were less savory than that? How do you see it?
I think I've got a very, very thick skin. So I grew up gay and black in South Carolina in the 90s, which is like growing up in an internet comment section. So I'm pretty immune to the hate. I think, of course, I have opinions about, you know, which attacks are fair and, you know, this is cherry picked and whatever. I think it was fine. I think all is fair in politics and we need to prepare for that. I think strategically, they made a huge mistake. They came at us guns blazing. The Twitter, you know, there's a really great article, you know, why does the internet not like Pete Buttigieg, right? They came at us full charging online and still do. If you check under Pete's, you know, tweets, for instance, right? I don't think negative emotion or negative partisanship works as well with Democrats as it does with Republicans. It works with some, don't get me wrong. But I don't think it works as well as you would anticipate. I'm so much prouder of the group and the engagement we built online for Pete because it was so positive. Like, you never have stories about, you know, Pete supporters doxing anyone, or Pete supporters attacking, you know, elected officials. Or there was a moment during the campaign where sort of overzealous Bernie Sanders supporters, who are not, by the way, representative of all Bernie Sanders supporters, attacked Addie Barkin because Addie Barkin was being too positive or supporting Elizabeth Warren. So that negativeness, I think you have to expect it and you have to anticipate it, and it just sort of comes with it. I think it's got diminishing returns. And I don't think it helps your candidate as much as you might think it is.
One of the, I don't know, storylines that definitely intersects with Pete's campaign is sort of race. You know, how did he handle race as mayor? How was he obtaining support in minority communities in the campaign? You must have opinions about that. What do you think was going on?
The thing that I love a lot about Pete is his willingness to grow, his willingness to learn and change. And so I think watching him throughout this campaign, one of the through lines attacking Pete was like, Mayor Pete, he's so white. The unbearable whiteness of Pete Buttigieg, right? I've never met a white man who was as willing to listen as him. The work that was done by our policy team, he did the work behind the scenes. And you can see that in the content we produce. His trip through South Carolina and stopping at the site of the Orangeburg Massacre to commemorate that, that was small. A lot of people don't go to the Orangeburg Massacre site. A lot of people don't know it exists. And we didn't really publicize it because he didn't think that was for public consumption. It went on some of the platforms, but it was just about him being there. The number of conversations he had about the Douglas plan, like going and sitting and listening. Pete did the work. I think what Pete got tagged with was unfair in a lot of respects. Nobody running for president last year not named Joe Biden did well with black voters. And that's just the sort of truth of the matter. And so I think what we need to do going forward is think about, okay, what should Pete do or what should happen? I don't think I have my head around it 100% yet. I think what I know is that Pete cares very deeply about inequality. And he cares very deeply about racial injustice. One of the things he's very, very keen on is the idea that Black Americans are the victims of a theft. He says this a lot, and this is not, I don't think, revelatory. He said this, you know, going all the way back to May of last year. Black Americans have been stolen from. a dollar stolen compounds over time. And we're looking at the effects of 400 years of theft, first explicitly in terms of labor during slavery, but then afterward with Jim Crow, and then afterward with the new Jim Crow. We're looking at centuries of systemic theft from Black Americans, and we need to not only put that money back and invest in our communities, we need to invest with interest. A race-neutral policy, and this is, again, this is Pete's Douglas plan, race-neutral policies are not enough. Your policies must be actively anti-racist. And like, we didn't get in the situation by accident. And so it's going to require intention to get us out. And so anyway, I stand behind 100% Pete's plans. I stand 100% behind Pete as a person. I think what happened was he got painted into a certain box, and it was very hard to get out of that box.
What are you up to now?
I'm like consulting and like working with these think tanks, and I'm like having an amazing time because, again, when we started this conversation, we were talking about, I'm very fortunate that sort of all of my interests have converged in this moment. Everyone is thinking about, you know, digital. Everyone's thinking about race and gender and being more inclusive. Everyone is thinking about politics. So right now I'm just consulting and really trying to help take the model we built for Pete and sort of bring it down to the lower level. Because the same community engagement model that I built for Pete really scales well with down ballot races. It scales really, really well if you're running for state rep, because you can do this online with very little paid staff. And so what I'm trying to do right now and what I'm doing and working with is a lot of lower down ballot candidates, helping them think through this moment. What do you need to succeed? How do you reach communities that are harder for maybe a white candidate or a male candidate to reach, right? How do you get in and provide them ownership? I'm a huge fan of Dr. Thomas Ballard's work. He has a great article on citizen typography where he talks about something called participatory aesthetics, right? Which is when you create a piece of content, and it doesn't matter what the content is. It's a tweet. It's a post on Facebook. It's a photo on Instagram. Doesn't matter. When you create a piece of content, you're not just creating a piece of content. You're opening up the door for conversation. You're creating a space for others to participate. And what they do in that space, you know, is entirely up to them. And so what I really am doing and what I'm trying to do right now is help down ballot candidates and some organizations think through, okay, how do we create space for conversations? And what do we do once that space is created to keep those conversations going and then move people up the ladder of engagement?
I'm curious what you think about the gulf right now between people who are steeped in sort of study of race and gender over the last, you know, few years, who see the world and have a terminology around that that is very different from the way that regular people who aren't educated in that speak and think about it. It's true about the fluidity of gender. It's true about race and things like rationale for reparations. There is a wide gulf in my view. How do you see this point in our country around that sort of thing, having taught this, you know, race and gender at USC for a few terms? How do you see where we are?
There's an indigenous tribe that doesn't have a word for the color blue. I think about this all the time. They went in and did studies, and it changes the color they see. They have words for words around the color, but they don't have that word. And so for them, the world exists differently because words sort of give us the language and give us the tools to understand what's happening. There is a gulf between the more academic side of thing, where it's very much about language and very much about terminology and definitions, and sort of breaking things down brick by brick, you know, the sort of deconstructionalist model. I think that's very real compared to sort of the average person. The average person, though, has something that maybe the academic doesn't always have, which is lived experience. So you may not have the word for the color blue, but you have looked at the sky. You may not have the word for the color blue, but you know when your water is no longer that color because it's been poisoned, right? And so there is a gulf. In my mind, the way to succeed and the way to make sure we're progressing forward is to build the bridge over the gulf, and because we need both. We need to make sure that people know the word for blue, and we need to make sure people know why that matters to their lived every day. And we're not necessarily doing a great job at that, but that to me seems like the great work of this generation. The work has already been done in the ivory towers about like this moment. A really great example of this is something like defund the police. Defund the police has existed for decades as a term. There's tons of literature surrounding this. I think of Angela Davis in particular. This is not a new concept, but because it blew onto the scene the way it did, which was sort of divorced from that context as just a rallying cry, right? There was a lot of confusion over what it meant and where it was going. And, you know, is this going to alienate people? Is this the right language to be using? Is this the right message to be pushing, et cetera, et cetera? That's a really great example of us not meeting in the middle and not figuring out, all right, we have this great thing, defund the police. How do we make sure that people who have the lived experience that would be impacted by this understand what this means and are able to move forward and advocate for it? So I think that's the thing. I think we're going to keep having those issues. I think that's a persistent problem. But I also think we've never, at least in my memory and in my lifetime, had a moment where everybody was really looking for that bridge to really like figure out how do we break down these barriers and these silos between lived experiences, between the academic and the real. Not to imply academic is not real. We should say the theoretical and the practical, right? How do we bridge that gap? And how do we make sure that they're having really interesting and intersectional conversations that takes into account both approaches? If you look at the New York Times bestseller list right now, a lot of them are books that are trying to bridge that divide. Things like White Fragility, right? I think it's on the New York Times bestseller list right now. So like, I think that work is happening. And I think there's obviously work that needs to be done.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm curious, with the experience that you have in Senate races and the presidential primary, how you see this general election shaping up, particularly between Biden and Trump.
Every president running for re-election, it's almost entirely always a referendum on the president. This president is a racist, and this president has used and stoked racial tension in order to keep his supporters engaged. He's been using fear and race since he sort of floated down the escalator at Trump Tower to say that Mexicans were rapists. The Biden campaign has turned their ship. I count myself as somebody once among them. People were very critical of the Biden team when he won the nomination or became the presumptive nominee about his online apparatus. And I think rightly so. I think what we've seen in the last couple of months is they took those criticisms seriously and made the pivot. They're raising millions of dollars online. Their grassroots support is strong. I think they just acquired something like 1.5 million more email addresses. I think they're running really, really smart ad campaign. They've got new videos coming out every single day, so they're constantly feeding the content beast. I think they've turned the corner, and I think they're going to do what needs to be done to keep the ship going and make sure that the Biden campaign has the resources they need to succeed. But I think they think, and I think there's some validity in this, which is being good online did not win Joe Biden the nomination. And being good online is not going to be the determining factor into whether or not Joe Biden becomes our president. And I think that's somewhat risky. That's a risky bet, considering the amount of money and resources and time and energy that have gone into the Trump campaign's digital operation, which we've written about other places. I think that's a risky bet, but I also think it's probably the right bet. I think it matters less whether or not Joe Biden is going viral on Twitter than is Joe Biden going viral in closed Facebook groups in Arizona, right? I think that's way more predictive and way more determinative and way more important than like focusing your energies and attention online necessarily.
Is there a temptation for you to be over there? Have you thought about joining that campaign?
We're going to no comment that and keep it moving.
All right.
I really am impressed with the talent that they've brought over there. I think the one thing I point out, and this is not a problem unique to the Biden campaign, this is a problem unique to digital in general, which is there are not enough, I think, Black people on Joe Biden's digital team. There are not enough Black people on a lot of people's digital teams. And I say that, you know, let's just say Twitter, for instance, right? The Black population in the United States is something like 14.5%. The Black population on Twitter is 28%.
Wow.
It's huge. African-Americans use Twitter. Black people use Twitter disproportionately higher than their rate in the population. It is one of the leading ways in which Black people encounter the world and build community with one another. The research on Black Twitter is real and goes back to at least 2012. And so when campaigns are stacking up their digital, and I'm thinking, again, Twitter is an easy example because we have fairly recent demographic breakdowns, right? But the same is true on Snapchat. The same is true on Instagram. On Instagram, a lot more people of color. They're just a little bit older than they would be on Twitter, right? If we do not diversify the people behind the computer screens who are helping candidates tell stories, then we're not going to tell inclusive stories.
I mean, it's obvious that that population is going to be aimed at by the Trump campaign to either demobilize people to try to get them not to vote or to persuade some.
Not persuade a little bit, because I think it's something like 8% of Black men. Right.
It's a little bit more than you would expect when I've the numbers I've seen.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the Trump campaign, you know, state actors, other nefarious entities, they want to depress Black turnout. We know this from the Mueller report. And so it's never been more important to make sure that your digital teams look like the people you're trying to talk to. And so that's the one thing I would say to anybody who's sort of listening and thinking of building a team or looking at their own digital program at this moment. If you're trying to speak to a community, you need to have that community represented. I say this the same thing about people who are trying to speak to Hispanic voices. It's not enough to just translate an English tweet into Spanish. That's not enough. That's not a program. that's not a strategy. What that is a sort of Band-Aid. What you need to be doing is, if you're going to create content and you're trying to reach, say, Hispanic voters, you need to be creating content that is speaking to their lived experience. And the only way to do that is to bring people in who know that experience. And the same thing for the Black community, the same thing for the AAPI community.
Is there a question that I haven't asked that you'd like to answer?
I think the most important question, especially looking at it from my lens, looking at it as someone who spent, I think, all of my life online, right, is the pivot post-COVID to digital is not going to go away. It's not going to end when this moment ends, right? Too many people are used to working from home now. Too many businesses have realized that they can stay profitable and maintain productivity with their workers working at home. Too many people have experienced a new world online that perhaps they wasn't available to them. And so I think, if you haven't asked me a question, I think the most important thing and the thing that I would want to emphasize before we're done is we're not going back to the analog normal. A new digital world is in the process of being birthed, and it's being birthed right now. And so if you're trying to be a change maker, and if you're trying to move the needle on progressive issues, if you're trying to really take advantage of this very historic moment we're in, you cannot build with the expectation that analog is coming back. Digital is where we're going. We should be building tools and tactics and strategies and programs to take full advantage of that.
Which is slightly opposed to where the Biden campaign is going in your previous comments, you know, in their bets. But
the difference, I think, between a bet between now and November and a bet between what the world looks like post-November.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, Stefan, it's been a real honor to talk to you. Is there anything else you want to say?
No, this has been fantastic. And again, I just really enjoy your podcast voice. This is very soothing.
I really enjoyed the conversation with you.
That was Stefan Smith with Buttigieg for President. He's the Stefan Smith on Twitter. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.